Yes, it is the week after Thanksgiving, and nothing says Thanksgiving like a group gaggle of homosexuals getting together for a dinner party that goes awfully wrong. I mean, if that's not Thanksgiving, what is? So I wish that we had done this last week, but hey, here we are. Give people some time to spend time with their family, because I think a lot of, as in members of the queer community, I think what we do is like we spend time with our real families, and then we try to make time for our chosen families.
Yes.
And today we're going to be talking about two movies that is about those chosen families. And I think the main takeaway is no matter what kind of family you live in, there's always going to be dysfunction. I think that's the takeaway.
We'll see if I agree with that or not. I am Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast
about unoriginality. I'm going to put you on the spot, but this play holds a special place in Eddie and Rolando's heart. Eddie is with us, by the way. Say hi, Eddie.
Hey, guys.
Awesome.
Hi, Eddie.
But yeah, so this play holds a special place in your guys' history. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So this is the play that Eddie and I watched the night that we got engaged. I took Eddie out to a Broadway show. And I had a whole plan set up in which we were going to go watch a Broadway play. There was no intermissions, right? This is the revival of the play Boys in the Band, which is the movie we'll be talking about. Movies we'll be talking about. And I had asked Nicole, sneak into my apartment and light up all these candles. I wanted to look like Friends when Monica and Chandler got engaged. Unfortunately, she couldn't find parking throughout those 2 hours, which is true in my neighborhood.
It's
in my
that neighborhood. Bad.
It is terrible to find parking, especially on a weekend, because we have two very popular restaurants right in the same block. So as a result, she just could not find parking. It would have been a fire hazard for her to just light everything and leave. So we were kind. So she texted me. So I couldn't even respond to her because we had to turn off our phones for the texts for the play. By the time I got out, I rushed to the restroom and see I have like 100 missed calls from Nicole and text messages. I was just like, oh, my God, this is not going according to plan. And I tried to take Eddie out to a restaurant afterwards. The restaurant that he chose was closed already. The kitchen was closed because the play was so long. So I was just like, well, is this going to happen? Is this proposal going to happen? I don't know. We get to the house. Eddie started to get undressed and stuff. I'm like, Eddie, wait. Because I knew we had to take pictures. And I told him, it's just like, Eddie. And I got down my knee and I proposed to him.
Yeah. It was awesome.
In Aww. Retrospect, I don't know if Boys in the Band was the right play to see right before an engagement for a gay couple, but I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about the play except that it was an all-gay cast. That's all I knew.
Openly gay cast, too, which
openly
is
gay cast.
Definitely something we're going to talk about. I mean, I think it's pretty adorable. And now having seen the play, I even too was like, oh, what an interesting play to see before you propose. Right. But, you know, that's just... is going to really, really signify the difference between when this play came out and then between its new revival and new film on Netflix. So with that, should we get into some history?
Let's get into the history because I'm fascinated. Even having seen the revival on stage, I still don't know necessarily the full history of the play.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, in honor of Boys in the Band, we're going to call it Herstory.
Ooh, fair.
All right, so... 1968 is probably the most important year in modern history. I mean, off the bat, you know, Martin Luther King assassinated, RFK assassinated, Apollo moon landing, right?
Remember when
Vietnam
assassinations
War.
Were a thing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. What happened? What's up with all the cowards nowadays? It's just like we have so many.
Stop. Cut it.
Fine.
they made, remember that moment at the Olympics where, you know, they put their hands up for Black Power? I mean, such a monumental year, right? Things were changing and you could feel it all over the air. Elvis had his 1968 comeback special, a monumental year, right?
Is that the one where he is like the lights are in his name?
Yes.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. See, it's kind of one of his defining moments. And you know, this was a year before the Stonewall riots.
Okay.
So this is, and remember, you know, it's also important to remember that Stonewall was not started by white gay men.
Right. It started by a black transgender?
Yes.
Was she trans?
Yes, she was. I mean, by today's standards, we would call her that. So.
Okay, got it.
And yeah, so this is a year before that.
I guess we're not supposed to call her black trans. I guess she's just a black woman.
Yeah, she was a black woman.
A black woman. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we should go back and say that. Well, no. No, wait, no, but then it might be confusing. I think it's
black trans woman.
I think it's, you think it's black trans? No, I thought that they don't want to be identified as trans. I think because she was, oh, I don't know. I don't know the full history of Marsha P. Marshall?
Yeah, Marsha P. Johnson.
Marsha P. Johnson. I can't, so if I'm making a mistake, I do apologize, but, you know, I will acknowledge the fact that, no, it wasn't a black, she was not, how about this? She was not, she wasn't identifying as a man. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. So this is kind of like the atmosphere in which this play was written. Now let's focus a little bit on the playwright himself, whose name is Mark Crowley. For most of the 60s, Mark Crowley was actually the personal assistant to Natalie Wood.
Yes, that's right.
From West Side Story, from Sweat mm-hmm. in the Grass.
from the mysterious murder.
From her mysterious murder or / drowning case. Did you know that her mom predicted that she was going, like, a psychic told her, your daughter will drown.
And the mom did nothing?
That's what set up Natalie Wood's fear of water, because her mother was like, don't ever go near water.
Oh, so what's she doing on a boat with? Who was the other actor? There was another famous actor. James Cameron? Yeah,
her husband, Robert Wagner, and their uh-huh. guest, Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken, that's who it was.
Yeah. And somehow she was trying to get on a dinghy, and she died. Uh-huh. She was like, she fell off the dinghy and was trying. There's evidence that she was trying to claw her way back up and all this stuff. So,
right.
Terrible stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, Mark Crowley was the personal assistant to Natalie Wood. And, you know, Natalie Wood was a really big supporter of gay people. Like, she was close with James Dean and she was close with Rock Hudson. And, you know, Mark Crowley.
Wait, James Dean was out? I thought he was.
He was.
Was he bi?
He's part of the community.
Okay, got it.
Let me see the community.
I see. I didn't know that about Natalie Wood, that she was like, if she was down with the LGBTQ folks.
She definitely was. She was more open-minded for her. But she was like a child actress raised in Hollywood, so of course she's going to be open-minded. but yeah, so she kind of supported him, and she was like, you want to write, and you're out of, you know, you're out of work, and you're just being my personal assistant, so I support you to write. So he actually was able, through being her personal assistant, to have enough time to do it. And apparently, he wrote this within a 6-week period.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He kind of just went on a typewriter and he did it. And it's very much based on his own experiences. And he's gone on the record saying that he does not consider himself to be an activist. But this play came out of a place of anger.
Yeah, clearly.
Clearly. And just kind of like, you know, this is like the reality of what it is to be me and for other people who are like me. And that's what he kind of wrote the play with the intention of. So and 1968, you know, it's still very much not okay to be gay.
Right.
You got to remember that.
Yes. I was also going to, well, what it is like to be me, I guess that me specifically is not closeted. It's like semi-closeted white guy. I don't know. I've admitted this. I don't know my gay history enough. But you mentioned this is before the Stonewall riots. I know before mm-hmm. the Stonewall riots, you know, cops were constantly harassing gay men when they go to gay bars and stuff. So there was like this level of
congregate.
Yeah. So there was, I didn't even realize that. So technically, would that party have been illegal?
Yeah. That's why they're so nervous.
Okay. Mm-hmm. See, not realizing that just kind of gives a new, fresh perspective onto the play. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. To an extent, you know, homosexuality was illegal in this country.
Wow. Okay.
Not too long ago and deeply frowned upon within society. I mean, I think. So I was actually watching the special, and this is interesting. In the same year that he wrote The Boys in the Band, a special aired for television that stated that the people in the American public thought that homosexuality was the worst thing that was happening in society, worse than abortions, worse than crime, worse than anything. So, like, homosexuality was something that people were not okay with.
Wow.
And I think I'm going to try and play a little snippet of that right here.
There is a growing concern about homosexuals in society, about their increasing visibility. We discovered that Americans consider homosexuality more harmful to society than adultery, abortion, or prostitution.
Wait, do you agree with that report? is homosexuality the biggest threat to America's morality at the moment?
Are we in 1968 or are we in 2020?
We're in 2020.
Oh no, I think it's the saving grace.
Yeah, we brought color to that culture.
Seriously. Yeah, I mean, I will say, you know, looking at it from being 1968 to 2020 and how much things have changed.
Uh-huh. For sure. I mean,
wow. But when you look at it on the legislative side, when you look at it on, you know, more of the political side, things haven't changed as much as we would hope.
That's not true. Gay marriage is legal across the country.
I guess I'm talking more about other people in the community.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it is, you know, we all know this. The road to progress is a slow one. So,
yeah,
you know, I get it.
It is. It's quite unfortunate. I think our art and stuff is always going to be ahead of our actual time and our public.
Well, art is important in that sense, right? Because art makes the masses more comfortable with the idea enough, hopefully, that when a generation or two comes, they are able to make those legislative decisions that will change the country, right? So, we know a lot of the stuff that we've covered on this podcast has the introduction of like queer characters or trans characters for younger audiences. The hope with that is that like this will make these younger people more comfortable with this. Point that they don't have hate in their hearts going into the future, right? So that's my big diatribe.
No, and I 100% agree with you. And I guess we should talk a little bit about how this was received when it came out. You know, this play never played on Broadway. This was an off-Broadway show.
Ew.
And different though. You know, like Broadway was in its golden age in the 60s. So even if you were off-Broadway, you were solid. And you were like on the map, at least in the New York and theater map. You know, this show ran for over 1,000 performances.
Wait, 1,000?
Yeah. It was very successful. Famous people from Jackie O to Groucho Marx went and saw this play. I mean, this play caught on, which is why there was able to be a film version 2 years later, which we'll get to in a second.
Okay.
But by the time the next year that the Stonewall riots happened, public opinion about the play had changed.
Oh, interesting.
So when it first came out, it was a revolutionary. Nobody had put a play about gay men hanging out, being who they were unapologetically themselves, right? That was just something. Right. It was like people were shocked, right? Yeah. They had never seen anything like that, which is why they wanted to go see it. The whole idea of putting on this play was like taboo. By the time Stonewall came out, though, people were reevaluating it and being like, we don't like that one of the only representations of gay people is this.
Oh, okay.
And
I see.
According to something I watched about Mark Crowley, that's part of the reason why the word pride came out, is because this show has no pride in being gay.
Right.
And that was one thing that they were like, things that came out of the Stonewall riots were trying to do, have pride in who you are.
Of course. Okay, so I think that's a fair critique of this work.
I think so too. And I think maybe we should start talking about
this. I think for our audiences to really understand why that's so important is like, let's talk plot a little. So this play, right? And we're going to use this loosely because I think the two movies that come out of this are so, I think they use the same text as the play. So for the most part, when we're talking about the plot, it doesn't change. I think it changes maybe like very so slightly at the very end for the new Netflix one. But basically the plot is Michael is supposed to be a 30-something-year-old gay guy living in the city. I say supposed to be because I think all the two performances that we saw on screen, I don't know, I feel like they look older than 30-something, but that's just me. Is that okay? No?
I would say 30-something is believable. And this is also 1970s. I think the way people held themselves was like...
Late 30s, maybe.
I don't know. There's something about like the 70s that makes people kind of just like look older in general.
Maybe. I think... No, just true. I've seen pictures when I was in the fraternity. We saw pictures of the alumni and stuff. And they were in college age. And we're just like, wow, you guys look like old men. Anyway, I digress. So Michael is throwing a party for one of his friends... quote unquote friends, because I think it's more of a frenemy.
Yeah.
Right.
It's his very, Roy.
Yes. It's very Mean Girls shit going on there.
Very.
And he's throwing his 32nd birthday party. Now that's not believable. That is not his. He's this is like his 42nd birthday party. whatever. Before the party starts, he has his friend Don over. Don, is that his boyfriend? Lover?
Yeah, something that is not very clear in any iteration is their relationship, but it's, if you look it up, he is textually referred to as his boyfriend.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so I say that with a question mark because, as Nicole pointed out, it wasn't ever clear. Eddie, yeah. You going to say something?
Yeah, because I definitely in the Netflix, so the Netflix movie we just saw, version that we just saw, Donald felt comfortable being naked in front of him, but Michael still was like kind of like looking but not looking.
Right. Yes, I caught that too.
There is a mention that at some point they had slept together, they had hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems more now they're just friends.
That's what
they're
enjoying
each other's company.
Maybe they're friends with benefits. Kind of.
Yeah.
Thing.
Well, so Donald also has made it clear that he's moved out of New York City, so he's not really around anymore. So maybe that's also part of the reason why their relationship might not be like
good catch too.
Like together ish. Right. I don't know. So yeah. So Michael, first person to arrive is this Donald. Maybe it's Donald. His boyfriend.
The next major event that happens is that Michael receives a phone call from a former college friend, Alan, and Alan is like crying on the other end. He's like, "I need to come over. We need to talk." And you know, Michael, who is out. So I guess he's like out in the city, right? Like he lives in the city. The city could be a very insular place where you can be who you are in New York City. But when you step outside of that bubble, you have to kind of change who you are.
Yeah.
And I think that's true to a lot of people. You can be someone else. That's the magic of New York City or a major metropolis. You can be someone you're not. And then when you leave that bubble, you have to go back to reality, right? That's his situation. He isn't out to Alan. And Alan is kind of inviting himself over. Michael's just like, "No, I'm throwing a party for friends. You wouldn't want to be here."
Yeah. Well, Alan is also his old college roommate, right?
Yeah.
And someone that he's friends in quotation marks with just because of kind of like this past relationship. But because Alan lives in Washington, D.C., Michael lives in New York, you know, they don't really know anything about each other.
Correct.
I think that's also like, I think like to kind of piggyback off what you said, you know, there was the people that you could be yourself with. There was kind of like your safe zone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think New York at this time was kind of really unsafe for these guys.
Unsafe or safe?
Unsafe.
For the gays?
For them to kind of like go out and openly be themselves. I mean, like for him to leave his apartment and like pick up cake was even like a dangerous thing.
Right. Well, that kind of negates what I'm saying about the insularness of New York City. But I guess I meant...
I think you could find more spots you can have private moments. You know, definitely underground opportunities and more presence in the city, in New York City at that time. But it was always that it's like you had to be careful because if there was a group of us and we were all homosexual and the cops came, it's going to be an arrest.
Correct.
Yeah. If you were caught doing something, This was an arrest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And eventually, a lot of the friends start trickling into the party. We have a gay couple who have, it seems, a very rocky relationship from the start.
Hank and Larry.
Thank you, Hank and Larry. And we also have Emery, who is the more effeminate friend, right? He is not, he does not hide who he is. He's very open with his sexuality.
Yeah.
Next to arrive would be Bernard, the only black character in the play, who he has a very interesting relationship with Emery, by which I mean there is racism plays an important role in Bernard's story. And, you know, whether that's internalized racism or externalized racism from like the characters around is up to, well, it's not up to us to decide, right? It's just there. It plays a role. Next to arrive is Alan, and he walks in on seeing the group like kind of doing a dance and stuff, and he's just like, "Oh, we're just playing silly games and stuff," already ruining the vibe of the party, right? So this is a character, Alan, who just does not know how to read a room.
Yeah.
He should have left.
You know? Yeah.
But he does it. And next to arrive is actually a hustler, usually a younger guy. He comes in to sing happy birthday to the birthday guy who isn't there. Yeah. The last who arrived fashionably late is Harold. It's his birthday party. They party quickly goes south because of a fight between Emery and Alan that's caused by Alan's homophobia, right? He calls out Emery for his flamboyant ways that causes an actual physical alteration. After the physical alteration, Michael turns to the drink. And what we had learned earlier was that Michael had been 5 weeks sober up to this point, right? He was cutting back on his drinking because he realized he was making a lot of regrettable decisions when he's drunk.
Yeah.
We come to find out what those regrettable decisions can look like.
Yeah, he often speaks about how, you know, it's like he's not even like openly okay with, like, he's openly gay, but he's like got a lot of torment about it because of mm-hmm. his Catholicism. So yes. he more so goes under the whole like, woof, I got really drunk and what happened last night kind of like yes. lifestyle.
Right.
And that's something he talks about a lot. And that's almost, it is implied that that's almost how he can kind of deal with his homosexuality, because right. there's this whole discussion about religion and how he says, hey, if there isn't a God, all right, whatever. But if there is a God, I'm covered. So it's like you can mm-hmm. tell that he's actually really religious. And yes. to be religious and gay, especially in the 60s, there's always going to be some sort of, I guess not like torment, but there will be kind of like, oh, you know, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing and all that? So in the 60s.
Even in 2020. I mean, less yeah, so, always but like that. It, even 2020. I mean, 100%. It was only this year when the Pope was just like, civil unions are okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So. No, I definitely think that in some ways too, like the biggest kind of like, I don't want to, it's a better word for this, but like not enemy. But the biggest thing that gay people have to kind of like overcome is uh-huh. kind of religion, you know, learning to accept yourself and that it is okay to be who you are.
Yeah. Well, I don't even think it has to be religiously based, right? Because a lot of these characters have this own internalized trauma with who they are. I think the most important thing that this play is to really talk about is not religion could be one of the things you have to overcome, but usually it's yourself. You have to overcome you.
Yes, I guess more so because like that's where people turn to. It's like, well, in the Bible, it says it's wrong and stuff. So that's like the proof that people have that homosexuality is wrong. The proof right. in quotation marks. But I definitely agree that at the end of the play, with everything that goes on, we're going to talk about the major catalyst for the drama that happens, at least in the second half. It is about like being okay with who you are. And that's right. kind of like the message. But so Michael, like you said, gets really, really drunk because, oh my God, Alan's here. He just punched Emery. What the fuck's going on? Well, everything's out in the open. Fuck it. Let's play a game. And let's all grab the phone and call the one person whom we've really, truly loved uh-huh. and tell them that we love them. Tell them yeah. our name and tell them how we feel. And he tries to go one by one. And it's at the end of the play, it's apparent that he has an agenda. And his uh-huh. agenda is that he wants to get Alan to admit that he is homosexual.
Right.
And that does not go well for him. And the play ends with Michael just kind of like alienating every single one of his party members and crying on the floor, being held by Donald and then leaving his own apartment.
Mm-hmm. That's because two guys are getting it on in his bedroom. Rude,
yeah,
by the way.
He can't go to his bed, yeah. and that's kind of where it ends.
Correct.
Which, you know, it's interesting too, because when you're left with that, with the fact that Michael's character kind of had a 360, right? He didn't have a 180 and he didn't really learn anything. And mm-hmm. he's just kind of left with even more shame and more hurt. And you're left with him crying and trying to escape. You're kind of left with a message.
Okay.
At least I felt like I was left with a message.
What do you think that message was?
Well, so I'm trying to put myself in the mind of 1968, right? I'm trying to put myself in a time where it's not okay to be gay. Because I, you know, it's hard for me. I'm mm-hmm. lucky enough to be born to not have to have had to have experienced that.
I will, hang on. I will say this. You're lucky to be in the time, sure, because I think now is socially more acceptable, but it's also dependent on where we are. We're lucky
enough
to be
in the
Northeast.
That's true. And I'm lucky enough to be here. Right? Yeah.
So it's not just when we are, it's also where we are.
And I agree with you. Mm-hmm. But I thought about it, and it does seem like, you know, knowing that Mark Crowley wrote this in a place of anger, one part of me was like, oh my gosh, are you deeply critical of your own community? Do you mm-hmm. have a lot of almost like contempt for your own community? Or Are you mad at society for what they've done to your community and how they've kind of traumatized everyone in your community?
Mm-hmm.
And ooh, I don't know okay. which one it is. I think it's kind of a combination of both.
Uh-huh.
I think that the fact that Michael, who is the main character at the end of the day, who seems to be the one who's, I think Mark Crowley even said, yeah, I'm based on, Michael's based on me.
Yeah, he has admitted this.
He has self-hate, right? That's why he's almost like so motivated to out Hank so that he can make Hank feel like how he feels, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then at the end when Hank ends up just calling his wife and doesn't admit to anything and just leaves, Michael just hates himself.
Right.
And he even says, I wish we couldn't hate ourselves so much. Why do we have to hate ourselves so much?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that level of self-hate does make me think that Crowley himself does have contempt for his own community, or at least with his own, has problems with the fact that he is a homosexual.
Yeah. So I think I actually fall more to your second read, which is just like, I hate what society has done to us, that we can't be, that we had to live in these shadows, that we had to have these feelings and stuff. I, as a gay man, like a lot of my earlier work, especially in grad school, really revolved around this kind of self-hate. Cause like there was a long period of time where I had this self-hate, right? Like I hated being, you know, being different, being an other is such a terrifying thing. And if you could change that, like, oh my God, there was a time in my life where I would have given anything to be able to change that.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now I've come to a point, obviously right now, where I'm just like, okay, this is who I am. This is, I'm not defined by my sexuality. Right. Despite the fact that we do have a podcast that focuses a lot on our homosexuality, but that does not define me. Right. A podcaster defines me, you know? But yeah. I do empathize with Michael because that trauma of being rejected, right, because of who you are is just something that we all feel, you know, and he doesn't want to be hated for something he can't control, right? So this is how he lashes out, this is how he acts out and stuff. I'm not saying it's right. He clearly needs therapy. Out of everyone, I think the only one who was mentioned going to therapy was Don.
Yes, right? Yes. So, they talked about that in the beginning.
And I don't know. I think he's just angry with the way society is. I think he has a lot of hate in his heart, but I think it was also created by the society that we live in.
I think, yeah. I mean, where do you get that from, right? So, mm-hmm. Yes, he does have it, and he has a lot of contempt for who he is, but he got that from somewhere, and a lot of it is society, and that's where a lot of his anger that he wrote this play came from.
Right.
And it's been mentioned a couple of times that Michael is Catholic.
Yep.
He's Catholic, and that's something that he identifies with. He went to Georgetown University.
Is that a Catholic school?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Catholic
okay.
University. So, I mean, so he's surrounded within being within that community and having certain ideals or not ideals per se, but just certain, like you have to live up to these ideals of what it is to be a heterosexual man within that environment. And also because it's a sin and it's, you know, in quotation marks, it's been told to him that it's a sin and being raised this way. And then all of a sudden, recognizing I can't live like this anymore and have to break off from that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and being what we call, I guess, a relapsed Catholic. But he always ends with returning back to the church with seeking some level of redemption.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it may not be so much. I take it may not be so much about redemption of what I am, a homosexual male, but maybe the things that I do because of the anger that I feel, the transgressions that I do against my brother because of my own anger, of feeling of who I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The play ends with him going to
church,
to a mass.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah. A midnight mass, no less.
A midnight mass. And it just implies, too, that it's just like this cycle that's never going to end and that nothing has changed. And I hope that, I mean, it feels as if you're giving that to the audience and being like, oh, hey, but this can change because of you, maybe. Like, how do you feel about this scene that you just saw between a bunch of men who are in the closet? Like, literally, you could take it as that room is a metaphor for a closet. They're all hiding in there, right?
Yes, fair enough. That apartment itself becomes a closet.
A closet. So it's just like, if this makes you feel unsettled and it's sad and all this stuff, then like the way we can change this is by changing the world that which these people live in.
Correct.
And also, you know, it's important to note that all the people who were in the film were the people who played the roles on Broadway, off Broadway, and that these were all closeted gay men.
Wait, I'm sorry. In what? In the original or
in the film?
Netflix?
In the 1970 film, the one that
closeted?
Was, they were all closeted gay men. These men slowly died from AIDS.
Oh, six of them. Oh, no way.
A good majority of them ended up succumbing to AIDS.
I had just recently saw the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
The like is a half an hour on Netflix, and Crowley spoke about that, and he spoke. You know, he just said like, unlike the Netflix where they were all openly gay men, the original cast, six of them, and then three were straight, but they all faced the possibility of having their careers ruined.
Yeah.
Because of what they were doing.
Wow.
So I spoke about the bravery of what they were doing now.
Interesting. For sure. Okay, I mean, I didn't...
I was just going to say, to an extent, I'm sure there are many still closeted actors out there who fear for like that it will destroy their career if they come out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, for sure. That's a tale as old as time, right?
Seriously. Yeah, so really brave for them to do that. I think, though... Like you said, maybe 6 out of 9, I think one of them was Ruben Green, who probably was not. He played Bernard, and he's actually refuses to talk about, like, he does not want to be interviewed. He does not want to be questioned at all about this play.
Oh, interesting.
Which is really interesting. Maybe because of the racist element. So
there is some racial elements here, for sure.
Yeah, this one of the things that this play and these films address is that because gay people feel marginalized by society, they feel like they can relate to other people who are marginalized by society, and in this case they think they can relate to Black people because of that. So because of that, some of the characters, in particular Emery, make comments that Michael refers to as Uncle Tomming him.
Yeah.
And that is something that I think was actually really interesting that the play in 1968 touched on, where it's like, no, you can't do that.
Well, you specifically to Michael can't do that, the white guy.
And they do actually utter the N-word would be a couple of times.
Emery, okay, so Emery in the Netflix movie is played by a Latino. I'm pretty sure in the original one he wasn't Latin.
He was just a white guy. Yeah, he was.
I mean,
Emery
is a pretty white sounding name, but okay, I just wanted to just verify that. Because you know, sometimes you could be white and still look Latin and be Latino. But no, it's true. So I think it might resonate a little more so in the Netflix version, that thing where it's like, Michael, you can't call me, you can't Uncle Tom me. But to the Latino, it's just like, but he can, because he's already effeminate, he's already an other because he's Latino. And the other main thing is just like, it's a way for him to feel a little bit better about himself. And he, you know, Bernard admits this to himself that he also does Uncle Tom. What is Uncle Tommy? Uncle Tomming. So for people who don't know.
Belittling talk to Black people.
Yeah. It's not just that. It's also being subservient to white people.
Yes.
Is important. Is important element of the Uncle Tom trope.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's why. So I think for the Netflix one, this resonates a little stronger, just because of the.
They're both men of color.
They're both men of color. I think. Men of color.
Yeah, well, that the Netflix version too. It added that kind of thing to kind of. I feel like almost that moment had, and I don't have a problem with it, but it feels like it had more of an agenda, to kind of like point these things out to people. And
it's interesting. I think that's fair. I think it's. You know what's interesting though, because it was same cast from the play and stuff, right? So, but if you're watching these side by side, the two movies side by side, the speech doesn't change. I think it's just the casting that made that little subtle difference, right?
Yeah, which so also then changes the tone.
For sure, I don't know if I didn't pick up necessarily on. I mean, obviously there's an agenda behind that speech, but I don't know if it was. It doesn't change the fact, right? For me, I don't think it changes like overall the read of that scene.
Okay.
It does wake us up to within the sense of a class system within our own community.
Absolutely.
You know, the sense of what it is to be white, a white gay man, compared to be a Black or Latino gay man.
within the community.
And we talked about that last week. You know, race, sex, and class define our society. And the most important one, or at least the one that is most effective, is class.
Yeah.
Within all subcommunities, it's there. Sorry.
Do you know where you see the most... you know where, like, this is, like, something that's constantly getting called out on? It's RuPaul's Drag Race, right? Where the white queens can act differently. I think there's a lot more on the shoulders of the black queens, despite the fact that RuPaul herself is black, right? But there is the hurdles that the black queens have to jump through to get to be recognized are so much harder than the white ones. And in their Instagram and Twitter following, right, the black queens are always underperforming the white queens. Like, the white queens always have way more followers than the black queens.
100%. And, you know, I will also say that I feel like the people who come on the show who have more to prove because of kind of like what they've experienced in society and stuff are the black queens, not the white queens. The white queens always come so 100% sure of themselves. It's almost, you want to slap them, you know?
Absolutely.
Like Aquaria and all this stuff.
Ooh.
You're a great queen, but I want to slap you. You're way too cocky, and you were privileged, and you came on 21 watching that show and studying it. So,
why I was rooting for Heidi. Heidi in Closet.
What about Heidi?
I loved her. She was my favorite, and I wanted her. I wanted her so badly to be in the top three.
Yeah,
maybe
she'll
be an all-star.
Oh, that'd be so great.
Oh, she'd be great. Oh, no. I mean, now that she probably has a little bit more money.
You know that Jackie Cox is going to be in there, or Jan or something, because Jan wants it so bad. But
I could see Jan. More anyway, no more RuPaul. But no, but that's where I think racism for sure is something that is like front and center.
Yes.
Where you see it like in the gay community, like there is like this interesting race play that's constantly happening.
Yeah.
That myself as a Latino, like I don't. When I was on those like gay dating apps, right, I never had to deal with like you rarely see like no Latinos, right? But you do see lots of no blacks, no Asians. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's so fucked.
It's so fucked up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but even
then it's also too is the fetishizing.
Yes, 100%.
How you know minorities get fetishized within the
community. Oh, you're so exotic. You know? Oh,
that's also true.
You know, that kind of
it's just terrible. It's hard out there, guys. We can all relate to this. And, you know, and this play at the end of the day, you know, is a really good window into white gay men life at the time. And particularly, I guess, somewhat well off because what an apartment. Oh, my God. I love that apartment.
Michael's in heavy debt.
Well, does he talk about that?
Yeah,
he does.
It's like a big point. It's like actually it's Hallie's way. I forgot his name already. Harold. It's Harold's way of really like taking that dagger and stabbing him, right?
That was the first cut.
Yeah, that's like his deepest cut too. That's where
he goes, the pills that are paid for.
Yeah.
He does a series of like items that are paid for.
Yeah. Like, all these things are paid for. Yeah.
That's where one of the deepest cuts that he can get him in because like he knows it's the things that Michael is most self-conscious about is his debt. And his hair.
And he even remarks about gay men are worse than women about aging and all this stuff. Which true.
Do you think that's true?
I'm not a gay man, so you tell me.
Yes, I would say.
I will ask the question and answer it. Yes.
I don't know, Eddie. What do you think? Are gay men?
I think it's to each his own. And there's always this thing of like, I guess the stereotype or maybe the things that we perceive the most are like if you're young and you look young and you have more opportunities and you'll be more desirable, stuff like that. You know?
Yeah,
and then it's
definitely
like this need of like not wanting to become an old queen.
Yes.
You know, it's like fighting it, you know.
And one of the things Harold is hung up about. Yeah.
We've talked a lot about plot
about
here. Yeah, we're going like, we're going into the plot. We're going into nitty gritty and stuff. But I think we should really talk about the movies here, right? So, had you ever seen Boys in the Band 1970? Because you're usually the one who sees all the old stuff.
So you sent me the Vimeo link, right?
Uh huh.
And I don't know if you realized that, but that was kind of sped up.
Yeah, I noticed it. I noticed it right from the get go. Unfortunately, that's the only one version we could find. Did you find a better version?
I kind of did on YouTube.
And
it
you didn't
split
share
up
it.
Into 12 parts.
I can't believe you wouldn't share it with me.
Well, you already had a version, but I just I couldn't watch that. It was kind of unbearable for me. So,
I think I needed to sped up a little just because like, oh, this is great. It's like when you listen to a podcast at 1.5
speed. And you like speed it up. Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah, no, I couldn't do that. So I watched. And it's unfortunately this 1970 film version is so hard to find. And
it
it's weird because there's not a lot to like. I don't really know how this film was received. You know, I don't really know like where its place is in like gay history. I think it was like somewhat well received when it came out.
It was a milestone gay film, right? Because it was one of the first in queer cinema because it had like this like important like agenda.
It's a major American motion picture to revolve mm-hmm. around gay characters.
Well,
gay
that's
characters.
Bullshit because why can't I find it anywhere? You know,
whoa,
like,
that's
such a
that is a great question.
Like why? For sure. Like, so this is so monumental in terms of LGBT cinema. And yet, first of all, I don't think a lot of people are aware about it.
Fair
and
point.
Then I, yeah, the fact that it's unavailable to me is really, really shitty. And I will say that this film is, for the most part, well received, except for some people. And one of them being Pauline Kael. And she hated it. And that's like really, really unfortunate because I love Pauline Kael.
Why does she hate it?
She was alone and finding absolutely nothing redeeming about it.
Well, I mean, that's not true, I think, but...
Well, she found that she was one of those people who was like, this is too scathing, you know?
Oh, no, that I 1,000,000% agree with that. However, I don't know. I think it's a... I hate to say this, but even the 1970 version is a pretty... I don't know. I think I find both films relatable in that sense of just like, I think we all go through these moments. I feel like a lot
100%.
Of us, we go through these moments of self-hate. I feel like.
And getting just shit drunk and just like mouthing
yeah,
off
sure.
and embarrassing yourself. Yeah.
Been
relatable.
There so many times in my 20s, though. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
I think if these characters get and maybe this would have been a better if you taken because the Netflix version, right? That one, it takes place in it's a period piece.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you had modernized it and taken place in the. In 2020, you would age these characters down because a lot of these feelings, because of us being exposed to gay media and but still kind of sort of struggling with the closet, we experience this. I feel like we experience these traumatic moments in our 20s, like right after college, but right before like our lives are settling down and stuff, those traumatic years.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's how you would have done it. So maybe the 30s is just different for these men and stuff. You're right. So but I kept complaining that I feel like they all look older.
Well, you know, it's so and that's shallow, Rolando. Okay,
it's not
so
shallow they because they would agree with me.
Yeah, and then they would cry in the bathroom all alone. Yeah. So one of the people who really championed this, actually, and I think this is interesting, is Edward Albee. And Edward Albee's a playwright, and he wrote a very famous play called "Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf," which is pretty much the straight people version of this play.
Oh, that's such a good. Movie. I haven't seen the play.
So good. It's the play and the movie, you know, they're somewhat similar, but you know, it's about the straight couple who invite another straight couple over and then things go awry while they keep drinking, to say the least. And it's interesting because, you know, Edward Albee was someone who didn't want to shy away from the ugly, which is why I think he loved this play so much, is because there is a level of kind of like ugliness in this play. And it's interesting too because I think that sometimes it's almost so much focused on that a little things become a little some things become a little unhazy. For instance, the relationship between these men.
Okay.
It's very unclear to me how close these are or if any of these guys are each other's friends or if they're all just Harold's friends.
Right. Good point. Good catch.
Right. So one, you know, we don't even know that Donald and Michael, we don't really know what's going on with their relationship.
We also know that Donald and Harold don't really see each other.
Yes.
That often, right? Because I think especially at the end, it's just like, I'll see you at the next, I don't know, it was some Jewish word. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, so they don't really hang out all the time. And then then there seems to be something going on between Donald and Larry because Larry is very promiscuous.
Oh, no, something did happen between them.
Something 100% happened.
Yeah, they fooled around. They fooled around at a bathhouse and... because Larry and Hank is the other guy, right?
Yeah.
That's his boyfriend.
His significant other, yeah.
Their struggle as a couple is that Hank has left his wife and kids because he is now in a relationship with Larry. However, Larry is promiscuous.
He thinks he's gay. And he thinks that part of being gay is not adhering to the heterosexual social norms of monogamy.
Oh, that's so interesting that that's how you read that. I read it the opposite. I read that he admits that he is promiscuous. That's removed from him being gay. He does say that, where it's just like, I'm not gay and I'm not promiscuous because I'm gay. I'm just promiscuous. That's just how I am.
Well, but there's also this moment where he's like, I didn't bat my way out of the closet just so I could just be faithful to one person.
Oh, good point there. All right. So getting mixed messaging here. Yeah. But I think you're right. I think your read is probably the correct one, right? Where I think that's a common thing that you hear a lot with gay men, right? Like, why do you, I feel like, some straight friends ask me, like, oh, why are you settling down with Eddie? Like, isn't the whole point of being gay to be, like, kind of free and, like, fancy free?
Who are these friends?
They're not friends anymore, are they? No. And I was just like, I don't know, because this is what I want. Like, people want different things, you know? Yeah. I don't knock people who want to be in those open relationships, right? I have a friend that is in, like, kind of one of those weird open relationship things, and they're straight.
And by the way, I prefer the term settling up with Eddie.
Oh, settling up with Eddie. That. Thank you. Again, very weird play to see right before an engagement.
But, you know, there are a lot of people who think that, you know, why are we striving for things that heterosexual people have, where we should make our own rules about what it is to be a homosexual? You know, why do we want to get married? Why do we want to settle down, settle up and have kids?
I could tell you why I wanted to get married.
Theory. Why?
I could tell
you. For the taxes?
Oh, I mean, that's a benefit. No, for the wedding. For the wedding.
Oh, yeah. Well, weddings are a big bash and
that's
a big party.
That's it. I mean, I guess we didn't need to get married for the wedding, but how do you throw a big lavish party like that and get all the gifts and have all the attention on me for one day?
That is very true.
You know what I mean? It's the wedding. That's why I chose to get married. I'm kidding, Eddie, of course, obviously.
But so all of these characters, they all speak to different things that are going on within the gay community. You know, promiscuity versus monogamy, you know, more feminine queens, white, black, they don't really go past white or black, and people who are conflicted with religion and stuff, and to a degree class. So having said that, these are the dynamics that are going on.
Correct.
Now let's look at some of the way that they come across in the 1970 version and then the 2020 version.
All right,
they're,
let's go.
Pretty different. So Michael in the 1970 version is played by Kenneth Nelson. Mm-hmm. And in the 2020 version, he is played by Jim Parsons of Big Bang Theory fame.
He, I think that is where he's most famous from.
Yeah, it is. And also, we should say that the 2018 play that became the Netflix movie produced by Ryan Murphy, all of the actors in that are openly gay men.
Yes.
And it was on Broadway and it won the Best Revival. Boy, how times have changed, right?
Uh-huh.
So anyway, so Kenneth Nelson plays Michael, you know, with this whole like confliction of Catholicism and him very much trying to fit into a society and but also be true to who he is and pretty much in his own way an alcoholic. Which Michael do you think better kind of conveyed all of that for you?
So I think for me, Kenneth Nelson as Michael from the 1970 film is the stronger performance. And that is not to say that I think Jim Parsons' performance is not as good. I just think Jim Nelson. It's just slightly a little better. I think it's a little more nuanced.
I agree. There's something very kind of like on a pedestal about Kenneth Nelson's performance. Like there's something very like, oh, you know, he thinks he's kind of like smarter and especially in the way he talks to Cowboy.
Uh-huh.
He's just more of a dick.
Yeah, it's a much more biting performance where Jim Parsons, I think for the biggest distraction for me from him was kind of his voice. It's a little too much. It might be like an octave or two too high for me for the character that is trying to be portrayed here.
I see.
Does that make sense? Like he's supposed to be on some sense a little straight acting. He's not enough, I think, right? Because when he answered the phone with Alan, for example, like, oh my god, Alan, hi, it's kind of, I mean, he didn't say it like that, right? But it wasn't that far off. Where I think the 1970s performance, you kind of have a little bit more of that, like, still masculinity, that kind of, you know, I used to do this a lot where when you used to talk to guys like for the first time, you drop down your voice like an octave or two, so that way you sound more masculine. He had that natural, more masculine voice, I think. And you
that's
know,
interesting.
I can't put that on Jim Parsons as his voice, right? We've heard it mm-hmm. for 11 years on The Big Bang Theory. So, but that would be one of the reasons why I think the 1970s performance is better. Jim Nelson.
Kenneth Nelson.
Ah, close enough.
Well, for me also, I guess the Kenneth Nelson one, it rings a little truer just because of his relationship with the Donald character, who in this one is played by Frederick Combs and in the 2020 is played by Matt Bomer.
Uh-huh.
For me, in the 2021, there seemed to be kind of like a lack of romantic chemistry between the two.
Agreed.
Which made it even more confusing as to like, what is their relationship? And I mean, let's just be honest here. The character of Donald is kind of like not important at all.
No, he's just there. I would agree with you. He's like wallpaper.
Yeah.
Out of all the characters, he's the most wallpaper.
Doesn't pick up the phone. He has nothing really happen. And then like that whole moment between Larry and him, it just kind of happens and then it's over.
Yeah. It's, Oh, he's literally only there to cause tension between Larry and Hank.
Yeah. Like also, I guess maybe also more of a motive for why Michael is going through all he's going through that night. But I mean, the chemistry didn't really hit, but it was more believable in the 1971, actually.
Well, I think part of that is also because I think you can see those two characters together and it doesn't raise any eyebrows. But if I saw Matt Bomer with Jim Parsons like on the red carpet together, I'd be like, what?
Okay, so Matt Bomer is a very attractive man.
I would say he's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, he's very good looking.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't know, isn't that kind of shallow to say that he wouldn't fall for Jim Parsons, maybe?
Of course it's shallow, but this whole movie is about being shallow. But not entirely about it. That's one of the aspects of arguments about the gay community, that we are shallow. And well, here I am kind of proving their point.
Yeah. That was going to say, like, that you're very much giving into that, so.
It's a horrible thing to say, and I'm not trying to save myself on that one. I admit this. I know it's a horrible thing to say, but it's something that us as a society, we always say this. Like, how many times if we saw a hot young thing with an older guy, what's the first thing we think of? Money. All right. And then when we see like a hot guy with like an older woman, what do we think of? Closets. You know? So, you know, yeah. Who I'm talking about, right?
Who?
Oh, no.
No.
Allegedly Hugh Jackman.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, his wife is his beard. Yeah.
So the saying goes, right? Yeah, but so I'm just saying, it's just like, so as a society, we're constantly doing this thing. So this is not the read from the play and these movies is not wrong. We're a messed up society for doing these things.
Mm.
You know, I'm not going to be high minded and try to change my ways. So.
What about Emery?
Oh, the Latino, right?
Yeah, go for it. Say what you were going to say.
I think that performance, so both performances are good, right? I think both those characters are always, I think, my favorite characters in both plays, in both versions, right? I think because they're just the liveliest, they're kind of unapologetic with who they are. And I think they have the widest range of emotions throughout the night, right? They go from being... you know, kind of out and proud, scared, sympathetic, and then just like they go through a moment of tragedy when they have to tell their story about when they're making the call, right? I think both actors kind of play this role where, you know, there's like this absolute heartbreak when they have to reveal. It's just like, yeah, I'm in love with the dentist, but you know, he told his girlfriend and the girlfriend told everyone. And there's kind of this moment of like kind of shame about it, right? And then when he calls and then like the guy's just like, it's like, I don't know who you are, and just hangs up on him. There's like this moment of tragedy. And mm-hmm. both Emerys play it so well. Yeah. I happen to just like the performance from Ruben de Jesus, I think is his name.
Robin de Jesus.
Robin de Jesus. I think his performance is just a little stronger. I think maybe it could have been because of the fashion choices. I think maybe because I also identify with him as a Latino, that kind of stuff. Despite the fact that there's nothing particularly Latino about him. They didn't change the writing of the character.
Yeah.
So like he could be still a white guy. He just plopped him in as a Hispanic.
Except for that moment with Bernard.
Except, no, but even with that moment with Bernard, they didn't change the dialogue.
No, but, yeah, but it kind of sense, reads though. Differently.
It reads differently, yeah, it but read differently. It, yeah. It reads differently, but they didn't change the dialogue and so meaning you could have dropped a white guy in there, so you could put a Middle Eastern guy. It still would have, the dialogue itself wouldn't change.
But yeah, I think, okay.
But either it all right, dialogue wouldn't change. Yeah, but it would mean more about them having a connection because they're men of color.
Yes,
and that would relate to that scene of class, because. When Harold tells Michael, you know, we're equal. You like when he says, "I warn you." You warning me?
Oh, true. Yeah,
he's
yeah.
like, you know, we play the game. I know the game that we play, saying that mm-hmm. we're equals here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
among everyone
yeah.
here, we're equals.
Right. That's true. Oh, you're
I
right.
am more equal than you because right. I know how to play the game. Yeah. I will win it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's true. Actually, I didn't. That's a fascinating read on that. But you're right. Like Harold is. The worst
or the best
or the best. Well, he's the best at the game, and you know the game is obviously like what would be the game, frenemies shit, like it's just like that Mean Girls mind games that Michael does think he's good at, but
or the game of being great at being gay,
self-deprecating gay man game. Yeah,
well, so you think Harold is self-deprecating?
I mean, he comes in and he calls himself like an ugly, he's like, oh, I'm this. So however long it takes for me to come over is my business.
But all his things are superficial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
They have all his flaws that he sees in himself are physical, are superficial. They are not internalized homophobia.
Yeah. Well, that's right? So his gripe is more so of like the materialistic yeah. thing, where Michael's is way more like.
Oh, that's it. Oh, they are. Yeah, they're definitely the foils of each other, right? One is yeah. internalized hate. The other one is externalized hate.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Look at that. We're just making just literary.
Connecting all the dots. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting when I watched the 2021 and I saw the character of Emery, you know, I almost had this conversation with myself where I'm like, okay. So 1968, interior decorator, Hispanic man. This is interesting, you know, because I don't know how accepted into society, into a position like that.
Fair.
A person of my community would be like, was he successful? Yeah. You know, and there.
Well,
was...
he was because he lived in like a high rise that has a doorman.
Yeah. So that
right?
was
he's coming out of the unless he's like. Unless he's like a partner that he, you know, that we don't see.
Yeah.
I think the implication there is that that's his home. He's coming out of the door.
Or one night.
But why is the doorman giving him looks? It's just like the doorman should be used to him by now.
Not necessarily. Does it mean we can.
Maybe that's true. You could always give looks.
Discuss.
Yeah. So I don't know. That was interesting. But I do think that overall, I feel like the Cliff Gorman in person performance was kind of borderline mocking. Like what it is to be a flamboyant gay man, you know, and
interesting.
Like back in the like in the 60s too, it was kind of like this, you know, like sissy, quote unquote sissy fairy thing. Whereas Robin de Jesus is very much just like I feel like was being himself. He's openly gay. He was in Camp and other Broadway performances and stuff. And like
Wicked,
he was in Wicked. He played Bach.
Wicked, yeah,
oh, I didn't know he was in Wicked.
And In the Heights.
He was in the Heights, yes. Okay. But I don't feel like, no, it's not a burn because how he was acting wasn't very over the top. It just so happened that it was like clearer to say us that he was gay, but he wasn't like, I don't know. It wasn't like excessive where I feel like Cliff Gorman went onto the excessive.
I think I know level. What you mean. There is a little bit of exaggeration in Cliff Gorman's performance that you don't get from Robin because I think as you mentioned, so if Robin does live this way, all he's just doing is just like just playing. Now I don't want to say he's playing himself because I feel that takes away from an actor, right? But like if he's just kind of he's playing what he knows, right? And I guess if being an effeminate gay, because here's the thing, here's the truth, right? When you're an effeminate gay guy, or I think Latinos or black people, like when you're an effeminate minority, Jesus Christ, you have it so much worse than a white person. You just do.
You do.
Know what I mean? So, you know, he's just, I guess he's just channeling his experience through this and stuff. And I think if you are an effeminate gay guy, a minority, right, you can only hope to be as brave as the character Emery that's portrayed in the 1920s version, because that's a level of bravery that
what
sometimes...
Year? What did you say?
What?
What year did you say?
The 1920. Oh, I'm sorry, 2020.
The 2020 version. Oh, yeah, I didn't even catch that, yeah.
But that's a level of bravery that, like, is just, like, unfathomable to me, right? To be able to be yourself in already a... Because, you know, both Black and Latino cultures can be so machismo.
Oh, 100%.
And as a result, like, if you are already... If you're already flamboyant and stuff, and you're still trying to be... And you're still accepting of who you are, that's, like, it's so hard. It is so hard, and, you know.
Yeah.
Think, yeah. Yeah.
That's so what it. About that's Bernard?
Oh, that's a good question. I might go with the 2020 Bernard.
Yeah, because I feel like that the character of Bernard is to an extent a pushover.
Yes.
And I feel like that was way more evident in the 2021 than in the 1971.
Agreed.
And that's solely for that fact. I think both of them gave great performances, but I think his relationship with the other men was a little bit more like evident in the 2021.
Yeah, I wonder if that's also related to the fact that, like, a lot of the men who were on in this production were also are much more famous than the guy who plays Bernard.
Michael Benjamin Washington, for example.
Yeah, which all of them have a Wikipedia page. He doesn't. And I'm just like, what? How could you do that to him? Like, he's from 30 Rock.
Wow. Yeah. is that what he's famous for?
No, I don't think he's famous for that.
But he was in it.
He was in it for a couple of episodes. He played Tracy Jordan's son. Or not son, I guess. He's technically a con artist who was pretending to be Tracy Jordan's son. Okay. But Tracy Jordan let him get away with it because he was changing his life for the better with the money that Tracy Jordan was giving him.
Aw.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. But yeah, no, I think he held himself really well in a cast full of pretty famous people.
No, I would agree.
One of them being the man who plays Larry in the new one, Andrew Reynolds.
Andrew Reynolds.
In the 1971, he was played by Keith Prentice. A lot of these names I'm not very familiar with.
You're not familiar with Andrew Reynolds?
No. In the 1971.
Oh, in the 1970s. Okay.
I mean, like Cliff Gorman, I'm familiar with. He was in All That Jazz, if you recall, which you just saw recently.
Yeah, he was the Lenny character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
Eddie's the one who recognized that because of the cross eye.
Oh, nice.
And he's just like, oh my God, we just saw him in All That Jazz. And I was just like, who was he? And he's just like, he's the comedian. I was just like, oh my God, he's supposed to be the fake Lenny.
Yeah. Which is interesting because he actually originated the role in theater, and then Dustin Hoffman played Lenny in the film. So then they were like, let's get the guy who did the theater role to do a Dustin Hoffman version of the character he played. So it was interesting.
Ah, casting. That is interesting. Okay.
But any hoodle. But I'm not familiar with the rest of the actors, but I'm familiar with all of them in the 2021.
Yeah.
Andrew Reynolds plays Larry, and Tuck Watkins plays Hank.
Yes.
So, and this is the one with the promiscuous relationship and whatnot.
Correct.
And like his boyfriend who passes for straight.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you feel about their relationship? Which version do you think kind of hit more home for you?
So that's a good question. I don't know. There's some moments where I do appreciate Andrew Reynolds' performance better than the other Larry from the 1970. And there's some moments where I also like the other Larry's performance, right? I think, for example, one of the moments that I like the most from Andrew Reynolds is when he's calling Hank from inside the house. And it's kind of like a dead silence in the Netflix version, right? Where everyone's just waiting. They know it's obviously him who's calling, but he just like gets his moment of anger. It's just like, it's for you. He screams at Hank, right? And it's played.
Hank is for you.
And he played. Yeah. And Andrew Reynolds is a great. He has actually great comedic timing.
He does. Yeah.
Right. And I think it's the moments of comedy where he shines the most. I think in the moments of drama is where I kind of just like less so. Where I think the other actor had those moments of drama, but like the moments of comedy less so, because keep in mind this script is supposed to be part comedy.
Yeah, it is.
You know what I mean? Despite the themes that it's exploring, this is supposed to be funny at times. So the other actor doesn't play the comedy as well, So this is where I'm like kind of split on that performance, on this performance and stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, Andrew Reynolds is so pretty to look at sometimes, though, and he had like a shirtless scene. I think two shirtless scenes. Yeah.
Oh yeah, he did. Yeah.
He did. Yeah. 2021 had more nudity than the 1970s.
It did. Right? Yes, way more nudity.
Way more. Like there was no nudity.
No. Yeah. Well, the 2020 version also had flashbacks.
It does. I think they use, and I've complained, I think I literally complained about this last week with Rebecca, where I am not a fan of flashbacks. However, I think they were done classy flashbacks, right? Where we're not hearing dialogue, we're just getting like some supplemental B-roll.
Some visuals, yeah.
Kind of accompany the stories they're telling, which makes sense because I know one of the critiques for the 1970 film was the over-reliance on the close-up and the over-reliance on, you know, but it's a stage play turned movie.
Yeah, like how can you be faithful and yet make it very cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of both did, I think they were both somewhat successful in making them films as opposed to play on film.
Oh, no, I 100% agree with you. I agree. And I want to talk about this later, but like there's something I find inspirational about these two movies.
Oh, okay.
I'll get back to that.
Yeah, let's get back to that. We just have a couple more people we're going to go through, like The Cowboy.
Oh, The Cowboy. I think I might like the 1970s one a little better.
Yeah, so actually, Mark Crowley met him at like a party and was like, oh, you'd be perfect for this role.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, and he actually didn't really do much else other acting, and he actually got into heavy drug use and died of AIDS in the 80s because he went right back to hustling. Wow. So that's kind of a tragedy. But yeah, so it's, I don't know, it's borderline kind of like, if it were me at least, I'd be borderline insulted that you wanted me for that role. But because he's just kind of the punching bag.
But he's a hustler. You know, and it's just like, well, this is, I could get to say I'm in a movie and
he is a gift for Harold. I think the only person who oddly enough treasures him is Harold.
Right. And it's like this interesting. That's like, it's those weird moments, right? Where you see him kind of being just nice to him, but you don't know if he's being nice to him because in a predatory way or if he's being nice to him in like actual genuine care for way, right? Because
human
like
to human way.
Yeah, he sees what he sees in the hustler, the cowboy, the midnight cowboy specifically, is youth and beauty that Harold himself lacks at the moment now that he's 32.
But look at how is Harold, I'm making an assumption here. Maybe I didn't pick it up from the 1970s movie. But Harold seems to work in art.
Yes, because there's always this reference intellectual
of,
art,
you'll never
man.
Be able to talk to art about him. You know, the topic about art.
Yes.
So it is like, it is maybe, I'm just putting this in, Harold looking at the cowboy as like a piece of work.
Oh, maybe.
Looking at appreciating the beauty.
Right.
Yeah. He doesn't have to talk to me. He just has to be beautiful.
100%. I mean, Harold is an intellectual. That's all we know pretty much about him. So, yeah, I think he looks at him. He's able to look at him in a different way.
Let's not forget, Harold is also a former ice skater, accomplished ice skater, right? That's why they call, that's why Emery calls him the frozen fruit.
Yes.
But, you know, that career can only last so long. So, yeah, so he probably went into, or he probably made a lot of money and now he just collects art.
Well, so Harold is one of the most important characters of the play, the second most other than Michael. So between Zachary Quinto, who played him in the 2020 version, and Leonard Frey, two very different Harolds. Who do you think kind of like hit, who's your Harold?
Oh, I think it might be Frey.
I think so too.
I think I'm going to go with Frey. So I don't know. And I can't tell you why. I think both are strong performances. I think I really do. But Frey has, I think he had a little more charisma.
Yes, I feel like Zachary Quinto was kind of going for like that cool icy guy, but like I think he was focusing on trying to be like come off as too witty or too cool and all this stuff to the point where it was distracting from his performance.
Okay, fair.
And I feel like Frey, was like closer to actually like reading the lines in an effective way instead of trying to deliver them cool, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and his body language was also stronger. For example, like. There was a moment where he just like pulls up the fan, right? And he just like, oh, I forgot what he said, but like he just looks great doing it. Ever so, I think it's this is like during the phone call scenes when they're all making their calls and stuff. And I think he's just, oh, I remember. This is when he's like, when Michael was trying to get Alan to make his call, Harold just like gets the peacock fan and he pulls it up to his face. He's like, I believe this will be the last call of the night. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why it's such an effective scene, because this is where the camera work is important, right? You're just seeing this like just this close up of his face being covered by a peacock fan, and it made me want a peacock fan.
Yeah. Or even when they're eating lasagna, right? Like in the 1971, he's just like, I'm so hungry. And then he's like, he's not too hung up on like coming off a certain way. He's genuinely hungry and eating it and enjoying what he's eating.
Right.
It didn't feel that way in the 2021, oddly enough.
Right. Because he sounded fake. I think Zach Quinto has this great thing. But that could be how he's playing the character, that frenemies tend to be fake.
Yeah, and I think he's reading Harold as someone who's a little bit more like somewhat superficial and hung up on these superficialities and external fixations. So he's so preoccupied with being like well composed and witty and all this stuff.
So this goes more to your point, where the 1920, I keep saying 1920, the 2020 version, you don't have a good sense of who these characters are in relationship to each other, right? And I think maybe the actors played it in that way, where in the 1970s version, I have a feeling they were more grounded in the fact that like they kind of do have a relationship, which is why maybe that Harold is able to eat so freely in front of them. Also, the next line after him eating is just like, oh, he's just hungry because he starves himself all day. Well, that's something that's how you would act that's how I acted for Thanksgiving. I starved myself all day. And then as soon as the meal was in front of me, I gorged and just ate like a king. So I empathize. I feel him.
Well, you know, actually I got to go back, cause I just remembered something, you know, about unclear of these people's relationships. You know, why is Michael so upset at Harold for being that late? He's like, you were supposed to be here at 8:30/9 and all this stuff. And immediately comes through the door and gives him shit. It's like, it's almost as if it's like, why are you this angry? Is it just cause you're drunk already? Or like, it's so weird, like immediately met with hostility.
I just took my first, he just took his first shot at that moment. And I feel like if I throw a party for someone and they're that late, I'd be mad too.
Probably. I feel like the 1970 version showed his progression to getting really drunk a little better than the 2021. Because in the 2021, I'm like, oh, he's drunk. I missed that.
And you know, I was looking.
Good point.
I was looking at the moment he poured the drink. And so the 2020 version, moment he poured the drink and how many sips he was taking. So for me, that anger was already locked and ready.
Yeah.
That level of intensity was locked and ready. And I felt the moment that his buddy, his roommate from college comes and he sees, because I feel like we think of like, what is he's thinking like, what is this guy thinking of me at this moment? What is he seeing at me?
Right.
And he's already picking up like, oh, he already probably thinks I'm disgusting, probably thinks I'm, you know, worthless, immoral, all these things.
A sodomite.
So he has already this anger already filling up, and then walks in Harold, you know, all like, I'm here. And it's like, first shot.
Yeah, Emery first just shot. Got hit, and then Harold walks in, you know, so all like, shit hit the fan for sure. Yeah. Yeah, and that is definitely, that's it. Like, that's kind of the inciting incident. Harold walks in.
So it doesn't matter what time he would have walked in. I think the anger, because of the events that had already taken place.
Yeah.
Emery being hit, already seeing his roommate, thinking what his roommate is probably thinking of him.
Right.
His old roommate, yeah.
And being exposed this way, he's like, I'm angry.
Yeah.
I'm angry at myself and everyone. Is gonna feel my pain and my wrath.
Yeah, no, he has 100% an agenda, and Michael like takes, you know, what's that saying? He doesn't care who's in his way of his agenda. Yeah, He'll like hurt who was ever there.
Right,
and it gets kind of painful. Honestly.
It does. Oh no, I mean that's
so uncomfortable. It's
so uncomfortable.
Both movies and even the play are so uncomfortable to watch for that very reason.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say this. I have been to a dinner party where the moment the guest of honor arrived, there was screaming. It was in my own family. It was my sister and my mother. Like, we went to pick up my sister for her birthday dinner. So I kid you not, like 2 minutes into the car ride, my mom is yelling at my sister for
forgetting to get together with her.
For some reason or something. Anyway, it just made it for an awkward car ride because there I am just driving, just like, oh, this is going to be a pleasant dinner. It shockingly was. It didn't turn into this downfall like this play. Mm. But I've been there. I've been there where the guest of honor gets yelled at.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I can't remember off the top of my head. I've had uncomfortable moments at plays at my house or at other people's houses, but I can't remember anything of this level.
No, that's true.
This is just too theatrical. No pun intended. Yeah. But so, last but not least, would be Alan.
Alan. We did everybody?
Yeah, we did everybody.
Did we say anything about Hank? Who do we pick for Hank?
We did. Oh, I mean, I don't know. Who do you pick for Hank? We could go back to that.
We talked about Larry. For Hank, I'm going to go with Tuck.
Okay.
I think Tuck had the masculine energy correct. You know, plus Tuck is just so, like, he looks like a superhero, right?
I see. Really? Tuck, you think so?
You don't think so? He has, like, those broad shoulders and that kind of, like, almost that chin jawline.
Yeah, I kind of see it. I mean, I feel like the Larry and Hanks had a little, I don't know, there was a little bit more care for them in the 2020. And that's because they're the only characters who actually have, like, walk away with learning something, right?
Oh, okay.
Maybe Emery and Bernard, but it's obvious so that the people who have grown from this, at least, are Hank and Larry. Everybody else just stays the fucking same, which is kind of annoying, but whatever. So I think that is hits a little bit closer to home for the 2020 version.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, I'm gonna counter that argument that they all stay the same in the 2020 version. I don't think that's true.
In the 2020 version. So wait. But this is the same exact play. How can in the 1970 version they stay the same and in the 2021 they didn't?
Because you get extra scenes at the end.
Which really kind of also is like, are you trying to change the point of the play?
No, not necessarily, right? I don't think the point of the play changes here. I don't think the point of the story changes. I think the ending just makes it, there's still enough ambiguity in the ending to give you, to make you decide whatever you want to decide. However, I think there's only one major difference. The major difference, actually, there are two major differences here.
Michael Sean's
running, right?
Yeah, his running.
Who is he running to, right? What is he running
to?
He might be running from something. What do you think all right, what do you think? I mean, what's your read on that?
Honestly, I didn't know what to think of that. He just exited Mass, and it almost seems like it's this kind of like internal thing. Because it seems as if it's this thing that's going off in his head and he just feels this urge to run.
Okay.
It doesn't really seem like he's looking at anyone to me.
Eddie? Anything?
No.
I also was a little
confused by it. I thought it was, I enjoyed that moment, that scene. Because it's like, why is he running? And I know the exact same street he was running down too. And it's like, why is he running? He's like, why is he running in the middle of the street? Like, what's going on? It's like, what is he running to? What is he running from? So, I mean, it left me that question. That question was there.
What was your read, Rolando?
I think he was running to Alan. I think he thinks that Alan isn't. So this whole play culminates with like everyone calling the people they love. I think Michael had a schoolboy crush on his college roommate. I think there's a genuine pain that he, I think there's an, ang- the reason he's so angry with Alan isn't because Alan is a closeted homosexual. It's because Alan
didn't choose him.
He picked Justin, right? And that hurts. That is a pain that I think, I've never experienced this pain. I've had crushes on straight guys. I found out a straight guy had a homosexual dalliance with another gay guy and not me, the pain I would feel, I can only imagine it. So I think that's where that anger in the 2021 is played from. Whether or not Alan is gay, that's up to us to decide.
Yeah.
All right. Which I guess we'll talk about when we get to his performance. But I think because Michael was so hurt by that, I think Alan is the person he would have called. Now, when the play all ends and stuff, I think he's running to Alan to maybe apologize, make amends, or just tell him how he feels before he goes back to his wife. Because remember, we don't know why did Alan call. That's a big mystery of the play and of both films. We don't know. It's up to us to make inferences based off of what we see to decide. Now we can talk about Alan's moment. Do you think Alan? Oh, what did you think? Which Alan did you prefer?
I suppose the 2021.
Okay.
Just because I feel like playing a character from the 60s who could be all of these things, but is at the end of the day a straight guy in a room full of homosexuals, I feel like I got more so that homophobia from him. And that moment where he hit Emery was a little bit more effective, because William Friedkin did this whole like chaotic film shoot for that moment, and it was like
very
all over the place,
messy,
and it was,
with the cutting.
Yeah, and it was just kind of like meant to be chaotic. And I get what he was going for, but more so the feeling I felt in 1920 and the 2020. Damn it,
Roland. Oh, you're doing what I'm doing.
In the 2020 version, and because of that, and also like his relationship that he developed right there with Hank, I thought was actually a little bit more interesting in the 2021. But agreed. I, at the end of the day, do think that he's at least straight in the sense where he would, if he was, he would never admit it openly, even
Fair
to
enough.
Michael. What do you think?
Okay, so this is again where there's slight differences in the very end. In the 1970 film, he does not admit, he doesn't tell the audience or Michael why he stopped being friends with Justin. Michael makes an assumption that it's because they both could be straight together, but like gay on the side, you know, be on the down low, as we call it. In the 1971, he says, no, the reason I ended things with Justin is because he told me who he was and it disgusted me. And I could never look at him the same way. And that's why we're not friends anymore. He admits to his homophobia in the 1971. In the 2021, there's ambiguity. They take out that. They take out those lines, which leads you to believe when he called. Why? Which begs the question. Why did he call Alan? Michael. Why did Alan call Michael? We don't know. Is Alan possibly? Did he in fact leave his wife because he was considering turning to a homosexual life? I don't know. We don't know. What we know at the very end is that he ends up at a bar all by himself, right? The first thing what he told his wife was, like, I'm getting on the first plane out. He's so conflicted with his feelings. And he had many opportunities to leave the party when he found that there was all homosexuals. It was, again, this is not a hard, you read the room, man. Like, it's just like, they're not hiding it. The only one who is hiding it actively is Michael.
Yeah.
So I actually kind of prefer the ambiguity of the 2020 version.
I see.
I think it gives the character a little more like, oh, is he, isn't he? What is his secret? I don't know. I want to know more about you, Alan.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that you might be, are you homophobic, or is this also internalized homophobia that you're feeling?
So that's really interesting. And I think now it's a good time to focus on the way that these two films are different, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the 2021, which was directed by Joe Mantello, which was the stage director of the 2018 play, right?
Okay.
Brian Murphy hired him to direct the film. There's way more of a difference, I guess, in these relationships, right? We see the flashbacks, but they're just visuals. Like when Bernard's talking about that white boy he grew up loving, when Emery's talking about, you know, his prom and the dentist and whatnot. You know, we visually see these things.
Yes.
In the beginning, even though we see a lot of visuals of where people are coming from, and, you know, there's a shot of them at Julius Bar in both films and whatnot, this one actually has them, what they're doing after, which is kind of new writing, right? Mark Crowley never, ever shows you what happens when they leave the room, but this film does. And this film ends up kind of coming up with its own theories. Mm-hmm. One of them is that Alan goes to a bar and drinks alone, even though he said he was going to go home to his wife. So that is also the film taking their own definitive take on who Alan is.
Well, I don't know if it's they don't. All right. They don't pan out enough to make it. We don't know if it's a gay bar. Were they gay bars back then? I guess so. Right.
Yeah, of course.
Underground. Okay. We don't know where he is. We know he's at a bar by himself. He could just be right now trying to process everything that he's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
They left it ambiguous enough where we don't know.
Yeah.
I can't definitively say, like, oh, it's a gay bar. There were no clues there. It's just subtle enough where it's just like he is still processing what happened tonight.
No,
he could be processing the fact that he's in fact in love with his wife. I don't know.
But I guess kind of based on everything you say, it does seem like they want you to lean more to maybe Alan is gay based on the things that they've changed and the things they decided to show us.
I also, but as yes, I think they're kind of hinting that, okay, how about this? I think, I don't know if the filmmakers are leaning to make Alan gay. I'm thinking they're leaning, they're trying to lean evidence against him possibly being gay enough because I think sometimes gay men do this this kind of like mental mind work to kind of convince themselves that someone straight is gay, right? To justify their crushes or whatever, or to justify those feelings of lust that you might have for that straight friend. Like, he talks to me a certain way. He must be into me. He's not completely 100% straight. That's something that like a lot of gay men do, these mental exercises to kind of convince themselves that like the way they're feeling for these straight men is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Or to make them feel like sometimes less. It happens all the time with celebrities. I know we joke about it, but like sometimes in the gay community, like jokingly, you know, you'll see a lot of these diatribes of people trying to make these arguments of like why some of these celebrities are gay. Shawn Mendes is like a big one. KJ Apa from Riverdale. Like, you know, these are like, they have these followings of these gay guys who are trying to prove like every little which way that they're gay. And I think this film kind of toys with that. They're presenting us with enough evidence to make us think he might be gay, but they're not confirming anything.
No, they're not. And to be fair to Alan, he actually did try to leave a couple of times and Michael insisted that he stay.
And so did Donald. Donald kept pouring all those drinks. I don't know why.
Donald was so not needed. Kind of annoying.
Seriously, you think Donald was needed?
No, not at all. I mean, he didn't add anything. He just seemed to have somewhat of a purpose in terms of the text, but not in terms of the heart.
But he's so pretty.
Yeah, well, he was pretty wallpaper. At least in the 2021. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like all of these things that the 2020 added to it was trying to add this new level to the story, trying to answer or maybe present us with new questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe add it a little bit more because like we said in the 1971, it seemed that Alan was definitely straight and at least really, really homophobic.
Yes, I would say in the 1971s, they make it very clear that he is straight and he is homophobic.
Yeah,
and so, that the feelings that Michael has towards him are definitely just like wrongly placed.
Yeah, and in the 2020, they've definitely actually, you're the one who really pointed out that Michael actually might love him.
Mm-hmm.
So it adds these things to it. Now, it's interesting because when this play came out in 1968, and even then, people were like, we don't like this the way that this portrays gay people.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2020. RuPaul's Drag Race, you know, we have gay marriage. I mean, it's somewhat okay now to be gay in this world.
Those are our two markers of society, RuPaul's Drag Race.
I think it's a huge
being in Target commercials.
Old Navy commercials.
That's right. Yes.
This is how much things have changed. But like, this was put on Broadway. It won the best play and there were openly gay actors. A lot has changed, right? So it's interesting that they choose to revive this play and all the questions that it brings up about what to take from it. Now, the 2020 version tries to fix some things, right? Or at least updated for a modern audience. But do you think that it succeeded as a whole piece in doing that?
You know how I love watching things backwards, right?
Me too. Mm-hmm.
I do. And that's what I did for this one. And I think the 2020 Netflix film is just as effective at kind of making me... It's interesting, right? I don't get this sense of self hate when I watch this movie. It makes me uncomfortable, but like I don't get this sense of self-hate. There is actually more like this feeling of just like, geez, like those, I, it's more like I remember myself when I had those feelings, and look at where I am now. It makes me feel pride in a different way. Does that make sense? Like, where I think something like RuPaul's Drag Race, where and we're using RuPaul because I think RuPaul's is something that like mass media has just consumed now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a perfect marker. I think RuPaul has this message of being proud of who you are. And there's like this kind of joy that comes with being who you are. This is a story of self-hate, but it kind of makes me reflect on the fact that it's just like, I know that feeling and I'm so proud of who I am now. to overcome those feelings. And I think it's more, if anything, I do feel sad because I think sometimes gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans people, we can't get past those feelings. Sometimes we are stuck in that pain. That's why, you know, be damned, we suffer so much with so much high suicide rates, right? Yeah. I don't think, and granted, this is not a story that's trying to tell you anything about that kind of stuff. It's not. All I think is just pointing out that these feelings that people experience are real. And some people can overcome them, and I think you have to try to overcome them. Some people can't. And what do we do? What do we do? Do we let them wallow? Do we just pill them up with Valium? I don't know. The play itself is not trying to answer these questions. It's just like kind of shining a light on these, on these feelings.
Wow, interesting. So in that regard, do you think it was needed?
I think it was needed because you mentioned it. The 1971 is so hard to find, and I don't know how many people saw the revival on Broadway, right? I was, mm-hmm. you know, me and Eddie happened to be two of them. It was a full house when we saw it. Ooh, bonus fact, guys. I got to see Matt Bomer's penis in real life in the play because he actually goes full nude. Mm. And from the angle that we were sitting in, like, there was a mirror that's just showing you the night that I got engaged, I saw Matt Bomer's penis. Oh, my God. Isn't that interesting? Eddie?
That's your autobiography title.
That is. Oh, my God. That's a great autobiography title.
Right.
No, I think it was needed because I think it is absolutely okay to create media that doesn't always. I think it's appropriate for you to create media that makes you question your feelings on sexuality and stuff, like your own personal feelings, like, well, a gay perspective's feelings that aren't necessarily just this out and proud thing. I think it's acceptable to create media that makes you shine that light and say, it's just like, I'm not okay with this. What's wrong with me? And like I said, I come from the school. When I was in grad school and I was working on my film projects, a lot of my early work really focused on this idea of internalized homophobia because it's something that I struggled with a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that the truth is doesn't get explored enough on TV and movies because I think there's a stigma to that feeling. Right? There is a stigma to being a gay person who isn't proud of who they are now. And I'm not saying that that stigma isn't justified, but I also don't think that stigmatizing it is the answer. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I know. It definitely makes sense to me. I mean, it's such a complicated relationship, I think, that people have with their own homosexuality simply mm-hmm. because of the world we live in. And when the 1970 film and the 1968 play came out, you know, it was very clear, I think, to audiences that I would hope it was clear to audiences that, like, oh, this is the world's problem. This is our problem, mm-hmm. you know, and the reason that these people are this way is something that we all have to kind of like work to be better. Stonewall happened and then people were like, let's start fucking fighting for ourselves. Right.
Right.
And it worked. And now here we are in 2020 and so much has changed. And now we're making this film, and it's a period piece. It's not a modern adaptation.
Correct.
Where we were back in a world where people were not accepted and had a lot of, in particular, this group of people at least, did not have pride in who they were. So when you watch it with the 2020 perspective, one, it does make you, you almost have this conversation with yourself, right? Where you're just like, whoa, I can relate to this, but it's also uncomfortable, and in some ways I can't relate to this. You know, you realize the things that you have, but the mm-hmm. things that you also see that they have, that you also have still in 2020. So I think mainly for, it's interesting to look back because it's not that long ago, right? 2020 versus 1968, 1970, 50 years?
50
from the film. 52.
Okay,
from,
yeah, it'd be
know,
50 from
the
film. Yes,
play
correct.
Was written.
Damn, 50 years.
Yeah. Oh. So it's this kind of like balancing act with between that you're like, oh my God, this has changed. Oh my God, this hasn't. Oh my God, I can't relate to this. Oh my God, I can relate to that. And I don't know. The film itself, it's kind of, I am one of those people who are like, man, this is not a very pretty picture that you're portraying of the gay community. And it's not like the 2020 improves on that at all. It doesn't, you know, which is probably a good thing because it's close to the actual source material. But it's interesting because I kind of came into this being like, I don't know. I wish this was a little bit more prideful. And over the course of this conversation and some of the stuff that you said about Michael's read into your read into Michael's relationship with Ellen has kind of made me think that maybe the point of the remake of the 2020 was to kind of shine a little bit more sympathy onto these people. And to understand why they are so full of hate instead of just saying we're full of hate and this sucks and society sucks and bam, here's a play in 1968 because of it.
Right.
It's you're looking at it from all these years later and you understand why. And I think that the film kind of does makes it within that understanding tone of why they are this way. Mm-hmm. And it makes it somewhat sadder.
Oh, no, for sure. I would agree.
And I guess it's just, it's interesting because you should learn about this piece and its place in our society, and then you should figure out how you feel about it. And I think in that case, it is very much needed, especially because, yeah, if you get something put on Netflix in 2020 with an all-star cast like this, people will see it, and that yeah, itself is needed.
For sure. I will say this. So I did mention there's one thing that I did like about both productions that kind of made me feel inspired as a filmmaker, and that would be one of the things I'm constantly preaching to my mentees is when it comes to filmmaking, because I do mentorships for college age students, but I'm constantly preaching to them, it's just like, just create work. I don't, you know, don't focus so much on these lavish set pieces, right? Mm-hmm. These are two films that just took place in, for the most part, one setting.
Yeah.
And you can tell effective stories that are character driven in one setting. And let's be, is the camera work for both these films exquisite? Not particularly. I think there were some, I did appreciate kind of the close-ups, the use of close-up in the 1971 over the wide, there was like a weird wide lens that they were using in the Netflix version. I don't know if you caught that. It distorted the image a lot on some of those, on some of those medium shots, and it was just a little distracting. Ooh. However, the point still stands. It's just one setting. And I think as a filmmaker, sometimes like, you know, I happen to know, I don't have a lot of money to make short films. It's probably why I haven't made many short films since grad school, but I think it's seeing a piece like this that kind of makes me want to go back into writing and kind of writing character-centric things that don't have to take place in all these settings.
100%.
And I think that's a great takeaway from these films, because you know, these are the 1971s could not have a major budget, and I'm gonna say that this film, outside of the cost of the cast, could not have had that. It probably wasn't that expensive to make.
Yeah. No, definitely. You know what I mean? Yeah.
So it's that kind of, I did appreciate that from both these films.
Cool.
Yeah. But yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think of this. Oh, I forgot. The last thing that's most famous about this, the 1970 film, is the first movie to use the word cunt.
This is the C word.
Well, you have to say, they use it like all the time in the movie. I'm giving you guys all a historical perspective.
Some people hate that word and some people love saying it.
I mean, I'm only using it to just describe the fact that it's the first time a movie had said that. Film.
We're going to put the beep effect over you when you say that.
That's fine.
Well, so, this ended up being, we talked a lot about this piece. There's a lot to say here.
Yeah, we're both LGBTQ. There's a lot to dissect here. Mm-hmm. And
there is. There definitely is.
It comes down to it. So hopefully you stay through to the very end. Have you guys seen this movie?
Hopefully you're still with us.
Yes, hopefully. But have you guys seen this movie? I hope so. And I don't know. Do you think we missed something? Do you agree with us? Do you agree with our picks over who performed better? Let us know. Where can people let us know, Nicole?
Please reach out to us on email, remakesrebootsrevivals@gmail.com. We're really active on Instagram @remakesrebootsrevivals. You can find us on Facebook, and you can also find us on Twitter, where Rolando is actually solely running that account, and tell them about that account.
All 5 followers. But you can find us on Twitter. The Twitter is Remakes Podcast.
Awesome.
And
well,
that's that.
That is that. It was Thanksgiving, but you know, happy end of Thanksgiving and happy start of the Christmas season, guys.
Yes. The holiday season is upon us.
Yes, so exciting. Because that means our birthdays are really close. So.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point.
Yeah, we're winter
Can't
babies,
wait.
So.
Can't wait. Can't wait. All right, everyone. Well,
on that note,
until next time, stay original.